Hi guys, I'm Jean-Michel, and today we're going to be doing something a little bit different. Everyone has that one friend that's anti-Bitcoin, and today in the studio, we've got mine, investment manager, Mr. Simon Psyla. Let's jump in. Mr. Simon Psyla, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Happy to be here. Very well, thanks.
Happy to have you. So before we jump in the show, give us a little bit of background on who you are and what it is you do in this world.
Basically, I'm a finance professional. Background is mainly in investments across different types of investments, real estate, financial. I work for a company which manages high net worth individuals and companies assets. So my interests are from a multi-sectoral, and I get to learn obviously research a lot of different assets, part of which is also cryptocurrency. So that's in a nutshell.
Super. So tech is something which is native to your day to day, right? Yep. But at the same time, you're not a fan of Bitcoin.
No, I wouldn't say I'm a believer in Bitcoin as the way it's intended to be or the way it's sold.
Okay, no. Expand on that a little bit.
Well, the purists of Bitcoin, or the rallying call, is that it's meant to be some ultimate form of payment mechanism, which is decentralized and no control of the banks and whatnot. But the reality is that its adoption is super limited, at least for the time being. And its use as a means of exchange is very inefficient, both from a cost perspective and as well from a reality in terms of, as a use case, because when it comes to transferring value from one person or entity to another, the most important and fundamental facet is one of stability. You don't want to be in a situation where I give something to you and the next day it's worth 20% less.
So I can agree with you that Bitcoin has multiple issues, okay? There's issues on the speed side, issues on the cost side, sure. But from a value perspective, how do you see Bitcoin?
Well, value is something which is always relative. Value can be created out of something which to somebody else is worthless. To me, just because something values someone, it doesn't mean that I value it.
Sure, sure. So value is entirely subjective.
It's subjective entirely. What has happened today? Let me jump to the conclusion of it. What has happened today is that the whole crypto universe and Bitcoin spearheading that has created such a mass following and interest because of the technological element and mainly the speculative element, where your average Joe and even a farmer would get on board because it's the next phase, has created so much interest that has driven up the value, the price more than the value. When you squeeze it, ultimately, is there anything left? That's a different story. Just to be a bit extremist, once upon a time, a Nazi symbol was very valuable because there were millions of Germans that believed in the movement. Today, it's worthless because most people have moved on from that.
Thankfully. Absolutely, value is entirely a subjective. Right. And to be fair, if you grab that same symbol and probably take it to India, you might get some money for it. But that's a different story.
That's what I mean. So many people use the argument of trying to justify crypto and even Bitcoin by the price, and no, because look, it's a lot of there's a following, there's this, but it's for me it's a flawed argument.
Fair. So the price, if you ask me, I mean, so I don't know much about traditional finance, far from it, okay? But what I can tell you is that Bitcoin is somewhat of a unique asset, because the fluctuations are so rapid and so ridiculous.
In fact, I was going to get to that. Today, the way I view it, at least, is that the whole crypto space, not only Bitcoin, it's become a measure of volatility, of the hype, of the hubris that there is in the marketplace.
Sure.
Because it's if you look at it, it tends to do extremely well in an environment where people are looking for to take on a lot of risk for an extended reward, and then performs poorly in an environment which is risk off for the right way.
But that also sort of makes sense, because it's in line with the nature of the beast, right? So like if you look at the 90s, when during the internet boom, everyone and their mother wanted to open up some kind of .com. In the same way that everyone and their mother had some NFT project last year, right?
Yes, and in fact, and ultimately,
had
what
the ICO
happened,
project in 2017, no?
And ultimately, what happened was that the market eventually came to its senses and yes, repriced all of that downwards very, very sharply.
Absolutely. However, in the long term, the internet became a fundamental part of everyone's life.
100%.
Right?
It's since then, it's morphed. And it's become, it's not what a lot of people envisaged way back then.
Fair, and that I think is also true of many of the world's greatest creation. Oppenheimer, for example, who famously said the words, "Now I have become death destroyer of worlds," created the atomic bomb, thinking he was creating a nuclear power plant, right? So this is absolutely normal, but and with that same argument, it's why I personally think it's okay that Bitcoin isn't a cash replacement system. It makes no sense as a replacement to a cash, and this is from someone that's been following it since 2011. But it makes perfect sense as a replacement to central banking, for example.
What's wrong with central banking?
Okay, what's wrong with central banking? So I look at, there's a few different problems, but if you really want to sum it up, I think 2008 is the sort of simplest way to do it, right? Which was, the market was propped up by non-factual information and is constantly in a situation where the powers that be are able to keep that ship steering in a particular direction. For example, the markets close every day, right? Different markets close at different times. And sometimes when things go haywire, the markets themselves get shut down.
All right, let me stop you there.
Which doesn't happen with the crypto world.
That's not a problem with 2008.
Why?
In a way, which is an interesting angle, the problem with 2008 and what went wrong at the time was you can almost mirror it to the tokenization that happens in the crypto space. How? The biggest problem with what started 2008, the financial crisis, was from
the bad loans and the wrong ratings,
repackaging those loans.
Exactly.
So they were tokenizing them in a sense.
Exactly, but they were lying about what they were doing, right? Because they were being given a rating which was fundamentally false.
But the problem was nothing to do with a payment mechanism.
No, forget the payment mechanism. That's a secondary issue. That I have an issue with the
with the payment mechanism, because it's a force for keeping a business or structure alive that doesn't deserve to live. That's how I see it. So, but keep that separate for a second. Talk about 2008. The exact example you were going to give, right? So dirty loans with falsified ratings, and as a result, everyone lost their money. But the banks got bailed out. But the people lost everything. How does that work in a world where you want to live in? I don't know. That's not a world I want to live in. At least.
But how does Bitcoin change any of that? How does it solve any other problems?
Because it removes any of the elements of trust, right? Like in the case of central banking, we have to trust the incumbents behind the central banking system. And everybody that makes use of it has to trust each other, because they all work together. In the sort of notion of Bitcoin, now it's a little bit more skewed down the line because the mining pools have gotten bigger, but let's simplify it a little bit. It's, you need to look at Bitcoin as a triple entry accounting system, where I make a deal with you, you keep your ledger, I keep my ledger, and Bitcoin keeps a third ledger. But nobody owns Bitcoin, so nobody can go and play around with any of the information on that one ledger. So I can never screw you, and you can never screw me, as it were. That's the ethos.
Well, what happened in practice with the FTX proved otherwise. Because ultimately what they found out, at least to date, is that where the value was ultimately stored was being manipulated.
Correct. So let me tell you what happened.
In one sentence.
Yes. So let me tell you why that was. It's because none of those funds were used on chain. So what FTX was is exactly what a bank is. What does a bank do? It takes your funds, it puts these funds in one big vault, and it says, here's your IOU. You own X in this pool. But the bank goes around and plays and does whatever the hell it wants in the back end. Now they have all the regulatory stuff in place to make sure that they do the right things, right? What Sam Bankman-Fried did was exactly that, but none of it was on the chain. It was all traditional mechanisms that were abused. The chain was never abused. The funds were locked up. BS funds were created on different chains, but the liquidity practically remained in this big vault.
So what was solved by crypto in this
nothing
case?
At all. Nothing. I think Sam Bankman-Fried was a lesson to the entire industry about what the potential is of things to go wrong. I don't think he's the only example. I think there's many other examples. Alex Mashinsky, for example, is a great one, the founder of Celsius. I don't think he was anywhere near had the same kind of malicious intent as SBF. But the point is, the blockchain industry is very, very young. So it can be very easily exploited in ways that we have just not seen yet. The banking industry has been around for a long, long, long time. So it's had a lot of time to mature and weed out the Bernie Madoffs of this world. And
in fact, since 2008, I mean, the industry has moved on, and nowadays it's become the complete opposite. It's become too regulated, in my opinion.
Yes, there's
it's the complete opposite. And my follow up to that is, why would you, as a depositor in any situation, choose to put either, like, for example, FTX, whatever other system, to put your money with a system which is completely not regulated, when you can have a system which is now currently a highly regulated system, which is with depositor insurance, with all the controls that come with the banks, with core equity ratios that banks need to
fantastic question.
So why would I go from a regulated, safe environment to the Wild West, essentially?
So there's two reasons, I think, from two different perspectives. I think the first is the masses will only adopt blockchain technology when they don't know they're using blockchain technology. Okay. No one says, did you see ChatGPT? It's machine learning algorithms are crazy and its neural nets are nuts and its deep learning algos are nuts. No, they just care about, you know, it just wrote this email for me or it wrote this song or wrote a script. Value, right? And I believe that when you create value in tech, you don't create it by pushing the tech which you're building on. You create that value by enabling a business case.
Yeah.
Right. So sort of that's one perspective. In that frame, on the other side, why would you want to sort of be outside in the Wild West? Because there are benefits and there are risks to trusting banks. There are like, let's say you were positioned wrongly in 2008. Let's say you don't have the financial experience that you do, right, to be able to react to certain things in a way which for you is second nature. But for the person on the street, it's something that they could never comprehend, never in a million years, right? That person on the street puts money under their mattress. Holding your own Bitcoin in a self-custodial wallet is a digital equivalent to putting money under your own mattress.
But ultimately, what difference does it make if you're holding Bitcoin or euros at your local bank in that respect?
You because if the bank if the bank doesn't deposit, like Simon Psyla,
depositors didn't lose their cash in 2008.
Depositors didn't lose their cash, but the people who invested in the products surrounding the bank.
Different. That's different. An investor is different.
Yes. But
an investment is different to a deposit.
To balance. Funds being held, sure. But ultimately, the those people who invested in those funds had, or let's maybe funds is the incorrect term. Those let's say. Financial offerings. Let's sort of broaden it a little bit.
Well, the assets took a tumble. The real estate took a tumble, obviously, because of the people defaulting, essentially. And the real with assets fell because there was a financial crisis. I mean, obviously there was a lot of gloom and everything. Everyone was selling off, so all the real world assets sold off. So that's where the trauma came in for the average investor. That's where they lost their money. It's because they lost their investment, not that they lost their cash in the bank.
Sure. But
that remained there.
Sure.
So let's go back to this because, you know, personally, I do believe and I agree with you 100% that there is a use case for crypto technology when it comes to creating better accounting systems, better accountability, and all of that.
Absolutely.
And digital contracts and if there were and digital money and all of that, for me that's excellent, fantastic, and there's a future for that, 100%. You know what I disagree with is the Bitcoin itself as something which is going to go from today $10,000 is going to be $1 million per coin in 10 years time. That type of language is dangerous. Because that's dangerous to the investor, because and it's not practical, because it doesn't make sense ultimately.
So I hear you, and I also think that there's tremendous amount of application for blockchain tech in a traditional finance. On the Bitcoin side, there's a lot of danger to I agree with you to make these sort of wild predictions, but when you've seen it go from $100, and I haven't made any of these fucking future predictions, I'm not interested, right? But when you've seen it go from $100 to $60,000, like $100 when only nerds playing World of Warcraft are talking about this thing, you know, and nerds in forums like 4chan and stuff like that, and now the cleaner in my house is coming to me. It's like, oh, what is an NFT?
You're going back to my previous argument, about John.
Wow.
At the ends doesn't justify the means. Ultimately, just because something goes up in price doesn't mean it's valuable.
No. Agreed. But let's separate NFTs and cryptos in general and Bitcoin, okay? Because there's 99% of all tokens out there are shitcoins, will be worth zero.
Agreed.
Okay? At least 99. And maybe a little bit more on the NFT side. But Bitcoin is kind of unique because if you, like, I can't think of any other kind of asset class to compare it to, nor do I, in fact, have the best reference. But if there was something similar I could compare it to, philosophically, it would be religion. It's extremely similar to religion. It's like, where is the value in a church? It's very, very hard to put a number on that, you know? But there are people that fundamentally believe that the way that the world is run today is wrong. It's inherently wrong. Because and it might work fantastically for now, which okay, this isn't the end of the line either. But if politically the West had to go a very different way, that kind of control will be used against us.
But you need to decide what it is ultimately. To decide what it is. If it's going to be a currency by design, then I mean it's not going to be. You can't have a cult following. You're just saying what I was referring to before. The cult following can create that value and can sustain it.
Absolutely.
I mean,
but isn't that the same kind of thing we have with the US dollar? Like, there's a cult following in the US dollar. Every time they print a new US dollar, there's no gold being sort of mined up and stored somewhere to back this piece of gold.
No, that was
abolished. Exactly. So wouldn't it be fair to say that the US dollar is also its own kind of cult following?
I wouldn't say it's cult. It's part of the whole economy and the way it works.
It's the winning cult. No, let's face it. And I mean,
everything. The thing is, what it all revolves around as well is ultimately trust. If all of a sudden the U.S. central bank had to start printing trillions of dollars,
which they did in 2020,
then the value of the dollar will obviously cease to exist, and there'll be hyperinflation, which was a repercussion, as we're seeing very recently, and why the Fed is now backtracking.
But let's not to push the hyperinflation thing aside.
I mean, ultimately, banking relationships, investments, it's all about trust. It's all based on trust. So
exactly.
I agree
so,
with you
so
in that sense.
Don't you also agree that to some extent, almost everybody has a price? There's a number that you can give someone, almost anyone, that will make them drop all of their morals and all of their beliefs. That number is just different for everyone. But
do you realize that that's even crypto, when we're talking about value, we always reference it to a fiat currency.
Anyway. Yes, because fiat is what you can use to spend basically everywhere in the world, right?
Exactly. But because you're always benchmarking it against fiat. As in, if you had to
fiat live, is the benchmark.
If you had to live in a world where only Bitcoin exists, how would the world be different?
There would be, okay, so
how would you assign value to crypto?
The value which Bitcoin would be assigned to would still be based on the market cap, but if Bitcoin was the reserve currency, there would be so much money in that market cap that the volatility would not be anywhere close to what it is.
There wouldn't be enough
coins to go around.
There doesn't need to be. That's a whole other discussion. So yes, there's only 21 million Bitcoin, but and there's arguably 19 million have been mined. I would say somewhere between 6 and 8 million have been lost, even though probably nobody will agree with that for the next few years. So there's a finite supply of Bitcoin, right? So we can trust that its supply is finite and that there will never be any more. And we can also trust that the people enabling transactions on the Bitcoin network don't.
Is that the fact that it's finite is a problem in itself?
Why?
Because over time, you have in fact, the money supply controlled by the central banks increases over time, because over time you have the net wealth of the world keeps growing from year to year.
Okay.
Over time, your economic growth yes. increases.
So if the
if
value
you're not going to increase, if you're not going to increase the money supply, people won't have won't as in it the currencies will become too expensive for the average Joe. So in a sense, there won't be enough. The price of Bitcoin will just keep growing and growing and growing.
Yes, but it also means that if we've spent all the pounds, we can create cents, and if we spend all the cents, we can create microcents.
Ah, we would have to have created a whole new infrastructure.
Bitcoin supports it natively, so it supports like you can buy 0.00000001 of a Bitcoin. Now, okay, yeah, sure, that sounds techy and stuff, but it's all about how it's explained to the user. If you're buying $1, but what's backing this $1 is 0.00000001 Bitcoin, but the user's interfacing with this $1 and the value, and that's where the value is. Then that works out fine. What doesn't work is when the tech takes over the use case, right? So no, I agree with you. No one's ever gonna buy. You know, I just bought 0.00001 Bitcoin, because that's just silly, right? Yeah. So the infrastructure supports this reality at the moment, and there's layer twos out there on Bitcoin. It's the Lightning Network that lives below this Bitcoin network with its own set of validators, its own set of rules. And every time the blocks get mined here, they get fed into here, basically. So it's like literally creating cents or micro cents from a pound. So from a technical standpoint, and again, there are still problems with Bitcoin. There are some issues now with the decentralization part. So I'm not sort of here to say like Bitcoin is gonna take over the world, right? But what I can tell you is that greed definitely will, and always has, and no
human nature,
no exactly, no human is immune to the Midas touch, right? It's like once you everyone has a number. And the nice thing about Bitcoin is, at least, I'd be able to do business with you, and we can keep an independent ledger on an entirely trustless environment.
Yeah, going back to the trust issue, I really don't understand why people have such issues, with the current system. What is wrong with the current system? What's broken in the way
okay.
that I can whip out my phone and transfer you money at a click of a button?
But you can't transfer me money at a click of a button. So let's talk about Revolut, for example. Technically, yes. The you can send me funds from your account to my account, and I get them in 1 second for 0 cents. Okay? But Revolut, what's the issue with Revolut? Revolut grabs all your funds, sticks those funds in individual liquidity pools in different banks around the world, and every time you're moving funds from an individual, from me to you, it's just a database.
Yeah.
It's just a database which they own. So they can go Vigo, Vago, Voom, and we have no oversight into what's actually happening. Like we have no oversight into this SWIFT network. Now, Revolut has been around for, how long has it been now? 7-8 years, I think,
more
something
or less,
like that.
More or less, yeah.
They got a banking license, I think, 4 years ago, give or take. They still haven't made money, no?
I don't believe so, no.
Okay.
They still...
Okay, because how can you make money if you're not charging anyone for transactions? You're not charging anyone to... There's no model. There's no business model in Revolut, right? That's why.
But
it
wait
works.
A second, wait a second. Well, that's a different story.
Okay.
I mean, when it comes to companies like Revolut, they are by design, they are not profit conscious. They are just want to grow their
agreed. Okay.
Their catchment.
So let's say
for them the acquisition costs of growing the user base is what creates the value.
Understood.
For example, to draw a tangent. for example, what many people don't know, for example, about Amazon is that Amazon loses money from its core business website nowadays. Yeah. It makes most of its money from the AWS.
Of course, and they didn't give any dividends out for the first 10 years, which is so fine,
for them,
right?
You know, profit and business values are not necessarily something that go hand in hand, because you've got growth stocks, you've got value stocks, it's a bit different.
Fair, okay. So let's separate that.
But going back to your question, ultimately Revolut, now this has a banking license. Mm-hmm. Before Revolut, because I've very early adopted Revolut myself.
Same.
Before Revolut had a banking license, I used to not leave large amounts in there,
sure,
because for me, it's an unregulated entity, as you're saying, what they're ultimately doing with the funds, God knows. And to draw attention to this, it's not only that, something which to me baffles me, for example, is in the gaming industry, for example, when I do a deposit with whatever, Bet365, you don't know that you're going to get, if they decide to go bust tomorrow, your money's lost, that's it. And they don't even keep segregated accounts. Mm. Gaming companies, they're not by regulation have to have two separate accounts. For example, me that I work at a asset management firm. There's no way you can combine the firm's funds with the asset funds. They're completely separate accounts.
Which is great. Which is how it should be.
And this is going back to the argument of regulation, because I mean regulation is seen as a dirty word. In certain cases, things need to be regulated. Going back to another example. I mean, something I mentioned to you in our previous interview. I mean, for example, why do I have a regulation that you have to wear a seatbelt in the car? It's not that the transport mode as a ball buster. It's to ultimately because it protects us in the case of an accident.
Yes, and to that argument, I would say the car was around since the early 1900s, but the seatbelt was invented by Volvo in the 70s, right? This is why so many people are dying in blockchain cars, as it were, because we still haven't figured out that we need a seatbelt. Understand? So
and that's fine.
To be clear, right?
And that's fine. Going back to the Revolut question, once in my case, once Revolut got a banking license, I was much more comfortable to put in larger amounts.
Yes.
Because then the deposit insurance came into play as well. I think up to 100,000 euros, your deposit is insured by the banking central mm-hmm. bank essentially. So that gives comfort for the average investor, because most people would fall into that bracket to leave their money with this particular entity.
Yeah.
Apart from that, there are, as I was mentioning before, a whole host of different regulations nowadays, especially for systemically important banks, like, for example, BOV and Malta. You need to have additional capital buffers.
Sure.
You need to have, you know, there are whole different scales to ensure that the entity you're leaving your money with is adequately capitalized in the case of an emergency.
Absolutely.
What happened, going back to your 2008, is that at the time there weren't these capital requirements, and then ultimately the people that foot the bill are the taxpayers.
Okay.
Because there wasn't enough capital to make do for these losses. So nowadays, obviously, we live in a completely different environment. The regime is completely different. I mean, it's to arrive back into that situation. I'm not telling you that is not possible.
No.
But there needs to have been, I mean, a massive amount of lack of oversight. I mean, nowadays things.
I mean, wouldn't you call like printing a couple of $1 trillion in 6 months massive oversight?
Let me tell you, Jean. Let's not forget that going back, as in the central banks.
Forget
in my,
whether it was justified or not. Like that's a whole.
You can't look back at the central bank and even governments and say they did a bad job about it. Could they have stopped the monetary easing earlier? Probably yes. Probably 6 months earlier, a year earlier, which would have tamed or at least not have spiked inflation so much.
Mm.
But ultimately, let me tell you, the economies recovered so much and so quickly after the pandemic because of the actions that both central bank monetary policy and fiscal policy took. That, as in, if you look at the unemployment levels, who is there unemployed? In America, it was record levels of employment, as low unemployment. Mm. In looking at Malta, even there's still the way.
Yes, the unemployment rate is low.
The way it's also tough for a year and a half.
Absolutely, but it also doesn't mean if you have a job and you can't afford to pay your bills, it doesn't exactly mean that the system is fine either, right? Like we the world paid a price for that excess money printing.
Wait a second, inflation started not from the money printing. Inflation started happening before that. Inflation started happening during when the world was shut down, and it came from the supply side of the equation, not from the money side. It started because the world suddenly we were used to the luxury of living in a super efficient world. Our technology and the technological evolution put us in a situation sure. where me as an individual can do so much more with the power of computing, with the power of machines. And so now what happened in COVID is that all got disrupted. And people were not able to deliver and manufacture the parts that create a car. Because people were sick and factories were shut down. And all you need, for example, in a car with all those thousands of different elements that put together a car, or you use one which is not available, and then you cannot put a car onto the street without a windscreen. So what happened was that the supply side of things came to a halt, and then what happens is when you have both supply and demand create
sure,
a spike in price.
And I don't argue that it was that money printing was the sole contributor to the situation. My point is
if we didn't have the power, if the central banks didn't have the ability, mm-hmm. both central banks, which were the monetary and the government, which is the fiscal side, because they're two equally important forces here. If we didn't have the ability of these two elements to take action in the time of crisis, it would have been the world would have been a much more difficult place. Imagine those people living who were not able to go to work and not being in the services industry, particularly hospitality and whatever. Imagine they were not given the government vouchers and the relief and imagine the businesses were not given the COVID relief. You tell me what the hell they would have done. They would have been carnage, yeah? People breaking into supermarkets.
Okay, so we've had opposing arguments, I guess, on both sides of this field. Where do you see the two areas converging? Like where is the point where they meet, and where's the point where they separate?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, even myself, I'm a huge anything that comes to technology, I'm a huge fan. I'm a big believer in technology as a means to improve us as a civilization, and most of our investments are technology related in actual fact. In my opinion, as the rest of the argument unfolded, I do think that the current way that Bitcoin has been sold and most of the other crypto assets have been sold, and its current iteration is not going to achieve what it's being sold as. However, the technology backing it and is definitely has a use case, and the conversations nowadays surrounding that with digital fiat currencies and what's not is definitely an interesting time to see how these are going to develop, especially on the accountability point of view. Definitely the system, even banking, the current banking system, financial service system, payment system, definitely is not flawless, and there's always room for improvement. Adopting these technologies can definitely an interesting path ahead.
Fair. Okay. So I think it's interesting to see how even from sort of two opposing perspectives, we still can agree that there is a lot of potential for blockchain tech. Now, as far as Bitcoin goes, I hear you. Kevin O'Leary said exactly the same thing, and now he's got, I think it's 4 or 5% of his total portfolio. Invested in it, so I'm curious to see what your answer will be next time we have an interview in a few years. Let's see. In the meantime, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Take it easy.
Thank you.